Welcome to This Boring Life with your hosts Jake Waters and Johnny McFarlane. Today's subjects include Billie Holiday, vinyl records, the Black Keys, and the Stone Temple Pilots. So sit back, or lay down if you prefer, put in your earphones, and listen in to This Boring Life. Welcome to This Boring Life, Episode 2. It's a year in the making. It's been a year since our last episode, which was quite diverse, excuse me, in subject matter, but this one is going to be more music-oriented, and I believe it will be more music-oriented from now on if we do get to the dreaded Episode 3.
Yeah.
What do you think, Johnny?
I think this is a better step than what we've taken before. I think to really focus in on our listeners and our audience, I think it would be better for us to give our reviews and our opinions on the music that we have, or the music we listen to, because it's a big part of our lives, whereas other things we've reviewed and talked about aren't quite as big.
And, I don't know, I think it's time that we translate those to a more professional podcast setting, although I'm not saying that this particular episode is going to be all that professional, seeing as it is 12:36 in the morning.
We're doing this pretty much as off the cuff.
We just we have a few subjects that we picked out, but no real preparation went into this. So hopefully you won't notice that too much, though. But just apologizing for that beforehand. But I figured, you know, why should we wait and to get started when we can just go right in right now, Johnny? If anybody who does know him might may be surprised about this, has been getting into a bit of a jazz phase lately. You want to talk a little bit about that, Johnny?
Yeah, jazz has always been kind of I've always had an interest in it, a minor interest in it. It's always been a back burner. Everyone that knows me knows that grunge, the 90s, everything from the 90s is really makes up my musical taste. But jazz had a heavy influence, and just lately, I've really gotten into a lot of the swing jazz. Everything basically from the late 20s to, you know, clear into the 60s. Singers that started in the 30s, 20s and 30s that sang into the 50s and 60s. Notably, I've been listening to a lot of Billie Holiday, Billy Eckstein, Sinatra, Count Basie. A lot of these bands, a lot of the big bands and a lot of the swing era bands. But the swing era has always been a favorite of mine. I think it's because of the upbeat sound. It's not necessarily as complex as later jazz, but I'm more of a vocalist anyway. I like to listen to the vocals of certain singers, and I'm more impressed by that than just the music of instruments. But yeah, lately I've been listening to a lot of them very intently. Before I'd listen to it passively, like I'd turn on Billie Holiday and just listen to her while I'm doing homework or something. It was just really passive listening. But anymore, I've been really listening to them with from a more analytic point of view. I've really been analyzing, you know, where they were in their life events, and what influenced what they wrote and what they sung or what they sang. We've talked a lot. Me and Jake have talked a lot about Billie Holiday, a lot of her life.
Yeah, just recently we went to Hastings and bought a not pretty shoddy copy of Lady in Satin. It's not very held up very well. The person who had it before didn't take care of it that well because it skips a few times. But still, hearing her voice and the emotional power behind it, the first time I bought it and put it on, I actually had to stop it because like the emotions were a bit too much for me at the time, having just gone through a breakup. It's probably not the best album to put on if you want to.
It's a very depressing. For any of you who are jazz fans, listen to Lady in Satin. It's a fantastic album. And I won't go into her entire background or history, but she did have a very tragic life from beginning to end. And one thing that I absolutely love about her music is that when you listen to her albums from even like Lady Sings the Blues, when you hear the albums from like the 30s into the 40s, you hear the swing really influence, heavily influenced her style. and you hear the real upbeat sound. She has, like, I Hear Music, which is hugely popular. Let's Call a Heart a Heart, which is really popular.
She even has a hand in one of the first widely popular protest songs with Strange Fruit.
Strange Fruit, yeah.
Still, the first time I heard that song, it was, like, sent chills because it's just so haunting.
Yeah, and that's a very incredible song. But anyway, you listen to that type of music, and then you move on to when she really got into hard drugs. She got into heroin. She had abusive relationships throughout, and again, she'd already had a terrible past as a child. And you can hear the effect those drugs had on her musically, and you can feel the effect those relationships had on her lyrically.
It's interesting, like, when you listen to Lady in Satin, you can hear, like, she was only 47 when she made that album, but she sounds like a much older woman. And mm-hmm. You can tell that her arranger had a hard time trying to work around her voice when he, you know, would,
yeah.
He was a young arranger at the time. Johnny knows more about him than I.
Yeah, Ray Ellis actually had only completed his... Most of you who do know jazz would know who Ray Ellis was. He had only finished his first album, but Miss Lady Day really enjoyed everything he did. It was new, and it was a different style than what had previously been known. And she had him arrange Lady in Satin. And what's interesting is that there was almost a battle between the two, because Billie Holiday had taken a dark turn, a very almost depressive turn in her music style. But Ray Ellis, on the other hand, was very still upbeat, and he was kind of bringing back the later or the earlier jazz that had kind of sort of faded away. And you hear in the album that he's fighting her and almost trying to cover up the raspiness of her voice and the deep raspiness. He was trying to really bring out the little bit youthful voice that she used to own.
I don't think, I mean, it works, but I don't think he really realized that probably the main selling point of that album was
her voice,
because, you know, it just, you put that on mm-hmm. and it just takes, you just, your mind goes through a roller coaster ride of emotions as she, like, kind of drags you along. And the backing is really beautiful, but, you know, it's, you're listening to it mostly for the voice, not for, like, jaunty, upbeat, young sounding instruments. Though that's not to say anything bad about him. He does a great job on the album.
It's just that in that particular album, you really don't pay attention to Ellis's performance or arrangement as much as you pay attention to her voice, because her voice really carries the entire album.
The weird thing, though, is when you go on Spotify and you look at the album, she's not attributed as the main artist. It's Ellis and his orchestra that are attributed, which is, I find, kind of odd in a way, because, you know, outside of, like, you really, unless you read the back of the album, you would just think of it as a Billie Holiday album.
Yeah, you wouldn't really search albums by arrangers. You'd always search by, you know, the title player. But I'm not sure what the deal was with that, because it really, Lady in Satin was not a huge arrangement for him as far as popularity goes. In fact, it was one of her last few albums, and she died with $700 or so in her bank account. So, I mean, she was not very wealthy. She lost a lot of royalties due to bad management.
Different time.
And that may actually have a lot to do with the album. It's possible that she didn't win the royalties, or somehow her manager had messed up her copywriting licenses with that particular album, because I do know she struggled that with her entire life. She didn't make nearly... She was very rich for a while, but she lost a lot of money because she lost a lot of potential royalties.
I don't think the drug habit probably helped much with that either.
Yeah, I mean, and having a drug habit did not help at all. But yeah, she at one point she was insanely rich, and then, like I said, when she died, she had about $750.
Yeah, it's quite a fall there.
Yeah.
But moving right along, we also, just I want to make a quick note about that Hastings trip, and there's another lesser-known album that I picked up that I just want to give a quick shout-out to by the Don Ellis Orchestra. surprise, like ironically enough, another artist with the last name Ellis. His album Electric Bath, I believe, it's kind of an experimental big band album that came out in the 60s, merged electronic musics like the mellow, electronic instruments like the mellotron and guitars and sitars with a big brass band atmosphere. And I thought it was kind of an interesting experiment. I never really heard much like that before. The best comparison I can give it to is Frank Zappa's big band fusion experimentations in the 70s with the Grand Wazoo. Some of it, you could definitely hear some Ellis in his work there, but otherwise, you know, it's just an interesting experiment that you didn't really hear artists doing too much after the 60s. Did you have any opinions on that album? You were here when I played
it. The album was interesting. It wasn't quite as abstract as I thought it would be when you picked the album up. But I think for the time period, it was a pretty interesting and new concept. It's just that for the most part, it does sound a lot like just a regular big band. When they're all playing together, you really can't tell what is and isn't electric. The only thing that really stands out as electric is the piano. And you hear that because there's piano solos on more than one occasion throughout the album. And then there was one part where they, in the back of the album talks about that, where the trumpets played. They time-lapsed
the trumpets. He recorded, four separate, and they, looped them together into a single.
Yeah, it wasn't just a straight recording. They linked a bunch of trumpets, which was a whole solo in itself. And that was pretty interesting. But overall, I don't know that I would consider, if I were to put it up against, a bassy big band, I would say the bassy still outshine them with his regular orchestral style as opposed to the electric. And I think that's probably why the electric style never really caught on.
The back of the album made it seem like it was going to be the wave of the future.
Yeah. That that article reviewer wrote on the back of the album was just in love with him.
I suppose you kind of have to be if you're trying to sell the album.
That's true.
It was kind of interesting, though. Mm-hmm. Just an interesting artifact from the time that's probably overlooked nowadays when people think about big band artists.
Yeah. And then, again, on our trip to Hastings, we had a discussion about vinyls. So that was pretty interesting. Me and Jake have differing opinions on vinyl records, especially the new emergence. Most of you today have probably seen that there are a lot of albums that are now being released in vinyl again. Because it's the
hip. Which I think is great.
Jake thinks it's just the greatest thing ever. He argues the sound quality is better, and he sent me articles.
I mean, it's not necessarily even just that. It's just, I like having, something that feels like a full package with the giant artwork and the, and you can actually physically see the album move. It's just more of, I like the aesthetic more. I don't know, it feels more personal, I have a more personal connection when I'm listening to a physical record than when I just turn on Spotify.
Yeah.
And it just feels more human in some weird way, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, and with Jake, it's a little bit different because he's one of those people that we've known each other since grade school, and he's had albums since I can remember. I mean, it's been a long time that he's had albums and he's been collecting for a long time.
I started with Michael Jackson's Thriller when I was 4 or 5. I saw a vinyl copy of that in my grandma's house, and she used to have all these old records, and I also had a jukebox in my house that my mom had, and I just I always liked the big art, and I always wanted to have records of my own. So this was back when eBay was still new, so you could buy big boxes full of records for $3 or $4 in the mid 90s, and my mom bought a bunch of them. Most of them I don't personally want to have really anymore because they're not really anything I it's a lot of Journey and stuff like that, Whitesnake, but for the time it really cemented my love for vinyl, and I just grew to become kind of an obsession for me. Yeah. Now I have this huge collection full of money that if I had just kept and saved, probably would help me out a lot now.
And I guess Jake's background is kind of really the exception to the argument that we had, because, again, there are people, and I understand there are a lot of people that have been collecting albums for a long time that truly, genuinely understand the importance of albums, and I won't ever take that away from them. My argument, the argument we got into, really, and it was mostly just me forcing my point on him, was more about the emergence of albums, the re-emergence of albums. I really associate it to the new, I wouldn't call them counterculture, but subculture that has developed in the last 10, 15 years. You see it with music, with styles, with clothing. The hipster movement, as most people call it. I wouldn't really necessarily call everyone that's in it hipsters, but they like that style. And I feel the emergence of and the popularity of albums is directly related to this new hipster movement, because now it's cool to listen to these old albums on record players because it's not mainstream to do it.
Yeah, there's these people with portable like record players that go out and they sit in public and they have their like records there, and they're just, you know, have their giant headphones, and all I'm thinking is that records don't necessarily lend themselves to portability mm-hmm. that well, and that's where, you know, you have the digital age kind of has it up on the records, because you can just take your phone anywhere with you and have all, like, the entire musical library of the world in your pocket, which is still mind-blowing to me, but that's besides the point. You can't really do that with records, and so to me, the people who do that, I think they're just trying to look like they're cool and hip and trying to fit in, but...
And that's the problem I have, and that was the point I was trying to make, is that I don't think there's this reemergence of album popularity because people respect and understand the music. I think there's an emergence because it's cool, and people think that if they own albums, they're accepted into this subculture group. They want to be a part of something that's against the grain.
I definitely think that discussion has, or that argument has some merit to it, but I don't necessarily think that's the only reason that the people buy records. Because you made this argument earlier when we were at Hastings that you would only ever buy records that actually came out in the 70s, like right. the '50s and the '60s and the '70s. You would never buy a record that was like new,
remastered, and
I don't think that's necessarily the right attitude to have, because there's a lot of the times now that these bands, they put out a new album and it sounds horribly mastered through and digitally compressed through the CD, but they'll have a separate vinyl master that sounds much better and much more organic, and you can hear the different dynamics. I would take for instance, the last Foo Fighters album that came out. Now, I'm not the biggest Foo Fighters fan in the world, but I do enjoy some of their songs, and I did enjoy their last album, and I definitely noticed a big difference in the quality of sound on the record as opposed to the copy that I had on my computer. It was a lot louder on my computer. It sounded a lot more compressed. It just didn't sound as like a real full band, but when I put it on my record player and I actually listened to it through the record, it sounded like there was a band actually performing in the room as opposed to a bunch of sounds all crammed together to fit into the small space.
The issue I take with that stance, though, is that these bands are creating albums that sound good on vinyl because vinyls are popular. I don't think bands are doing it because they want people to listen to a better sound or anything like that. They're doing it because it's popular. They're going to keep putting it on CDs because CDs are going to continue to be popular. But they're making these albums for this group that continues to grow, that's buying, that's eating this shit up, because albums cost 2 to 3 times more. Some of them go up to 10 times more than the cost of a CD. So you know that these industries are pressing bands to produce albums that are going to sound good on vinyl, because they can charge $40 to $50 and people will buy it. People will buy a contemporary album for $40-$50 and they would never spend that kind of money on a CD.
These arguments you're making, I definitely agree that there is merit to what you're saying, and that there's definitely a point that I agree with, but I don't necessarily think that you should just not buy new albums by bands on vinyls just because they're new. Because I still would prefer to have something that sounds better, even if it is just a record industry ploy to get more money out of the albums. If that's the price I have to pay to get a better sound quality, then I will pay that price. Yeah. But there's definitely a bit of a problem there.
That's understandable.
Because vinyl sales are the only physical medium that actually is increasing in sales in the music industry every year. Every year they end up selling more and more vinyl than the year previous, while like CD sales go dramatically down from where they were 10 years ago. Vinyl sales are dramatically up from where they were 10 years ago. So I could definitely see your point with record companies starting to focus more and more on charging for new vinyls and having bands put their efforts into mastering the vinyl more, because in reality more people are probably, like, the serious music fans are probably not going to pay for a CD anymore, but they will pay an exorbitant amount of money for a newly remastered vinyl.
And that is part of, maybe that is part of why they feel they can charge more, because it is a better quality. And I do know it's more expensive to print a vinyl than it is to print a CD. But I just don't feel, I guess on principle, that's why I would, the principle of the matter and the principle of my argument is really that the people who are buying these albums are doing it because it's a fad. They're doing it, it's a craze, really. I think a fad is probably an understatement. And eventually it's probably going to fan out. I hope albums, bands continue to produce albums for those who seriously want better sound quality. But that's not the people, that's not the base, that's not who's buying all these albums. There are always, like I said, there are music fans like Jake who've been collecting albums for a long time, so it would only make sense, it would only be logical for him to buy bands that he enjoys, contemporary bands he enjoys, on album or on vinyl. But again, the majority of sales aren't coming from serious music fans, they're coming from this pop culture I would say it went from subculture to a pop culture. I think anymore this kind of defines our music and our musical era, and I just don't think the popularity of vinyls should be based, again, on principle. I don't think that they should be based on the fact that it's the cool thing to do, but I do feel that it's directly it's the primary, probably the only original reason why vinyls became popular, why bands started producing new ones. There is the added benefit that you have a better sound quality for those serious musicians or serious listeners who like the vinyls, but I do not feel that was the reason vinyls became a thing.
And there's definitely merits on both sides, so we'll let you, the listener, decide what you think about the vinyl issue. But moving on to more arguments. Johnny, earlier today, another friend of mine was over here. He's a big fan of the Black Keys. And Johnny got a bit heated because when it comes to the Black Keys, Johnny feels that they're nothing but a second-rate version of the White Stripes. And he gets quite animated when talking about the Black Keys. So I think I would like for him to restate some of his arguments for why he doesn't like the Black Keys on this podcast.
I'm not sure if I can do it quite as eloquently as I did last time, but and I'm going to sound extremely contradictive because now I'm going to become the hipster that hates everything that comes out that's new. But the problem I have with the Black Keys all started, I was reading an article, and I wish I could cite the article for you guys because I cannot think of it.
Was it the Rolling Stone article?
No, the article I'm thinking of was where the Black Keys spoke directly to, well, not to White, the Jack White, but they spoke directly about Jack White, and they basically played down any influence Jack White had on the genre, this blues rock genre.
Garage rock revival.
Yeah, basically, that has come to fruition, and what made them popular. And that's where I really first took an issue with them. I had followed them for years before, back when they had some underground stuff, before their 2000 release of...
2008. Oh, wait, no. That wasn't 2008. It was 2000... 2011, yeah, when Brothers came out. I believe it was 2003.
I had followed them for a few years before. They'd been playing for probably 15, 20 years.
That's a bit of an overstatement. It's about 10, 11 years.
Okay, 10, 11 years. Either way, they've been playing for a long time. And they've really just recently achieved mainstream success with the general audiences. And again, this goes back to the culture. I tie everything to this new culture that's sprouted. And I feel like the Black Keys are popular now, and they've really altered their style to fit the hipster counterculture. They've always drawn from older styles from the 60s and 70s. I'll give them that. But they've progressed into the sound that all these previous bands like Jack White, with the White Stripes, had already had. And the White Stripes became more popular in recent years. People have gone back and re-listened to the White Stripes, and Jack White just released Blunderbuss, which was a huge success for him. I think it's directly tied to the movement of listeners over the last few years. But when the Black Keys said that they were not influenced at all by Jack White and his music, I feel like that was just more of a personal attack, because Jack White has already said some very negative things about the Black Keys. There was an article that talked about how he had actually prevented them from recording in his record studio, Third Man.
A side note, Jack White is a big proponent of vinyl, and he's a big, large reason why him and Third Man Records are a large reason why vinyl has become so popular in the past few years.
And Jack White is a great example of why vinyls are popular, too, because he's one of those characters, one of those musicians that loves the old style. I talked to them earlier. Jack White actually uses microphones from different eras to record certain songs that he's trying to get a feel for. Like, when he recorded Conquest, that was actually a cover from, what was it, 1960s?
Was it late 50s, early 60s?
Yeah, and he actually used the same type of microphone that was used in the original recording. So he's really big with utilizing older sounds. But back to my point, the Black Keys, and the reason I don't like them now is because I feel like they pulled a lot, and they owe a lot of their success to the previous success of the White Stripes, but they lend absolutely no gratitude at all toward them. I do feel like they altered their music to sound more like the White Stripes because they realized that was a popular sound. That's become a popular sound in recent
years. Well, I don't think they altered their sound to sound more like the White Stripes, because I think initially when they started their career, they sounded way more like the White Stripes. But I think they've, unlike the White Stripes, who really, when they altered their sound, they didn't really change like what their core sound was. You know, they just when they were experimenting.
Like every album,
you could still tell it was like they were doing it for themselves. You knew it with the
White Stripes, but you could tell they were experimenting with different styles.
But with the two new Black Keys albums, and I'm not like a real big fan of them. I've seen them live; they put on a good show. But I can definitely see Johnny's point. And their two new albums, they've seemed to have gone in a more a more radio-friendly, accepting direction with their music in an attempt to get a mainstream audience, like adding, you know, making it more of a full band type sound when their original like studio recordings were real lo-fi, real you could tell it was just him on the drums and him on the guitar. But their new, like their songs like Lonely Boy and stuff, they just feel like attempts at like top 40 radio play, as opposed to just doing it because that's the kind of music that they want to make.
But that
seems like more of an argument against the way like fads, like the way you were saying before. Like right now, it's hipster type, like indie, like bands who are taking the indie aesthetic and the indie type sound have finally become mainstream acceptable to the radio play. Like you have bands like Mumford and Son who take the folk style from bands in the earlier decade who were popular amongst like the Pitchfork crowd, but you know, weren't really hearing those kind of bands on the radio. And now they've taken the most basic elements from those and have added easy to digest for mainstream audience. This is so they can get radio play. And I think that's what Black Keys have kind of done with their sound a little bit. I don't want to say they've dumbed it down, but they've kind of a little bit in an attempt to get a mainstream audience, which it's working for them. They've played the Sprint Center, which they never would have done 10 years ago. So, I mean,
I know a lot of why they changed their style was due to the popularity of that sound. And I think they still would have become more popular had they not changed their original sound from the early 2000s. But, like I said, the biggest issue I have with them on a personal level, even without the musical level, the biggest issue I have is that they've created a sound that is precisely the sound of the White Stripes. And then they've basically said that, and the White Stripes do predate them as far as playing goes. And they have talked about that they used to listen to the White Stripes back in the late 90s. And then they're saying that even though they have the same sound, they're trying to make the claim that they created this sound and that this is original. What they're playing is original, but everything they're playing has been done by other bands a long time ago. It just wasn't popular. And so what's happening is all these kids that are now listening to to Black Keys they think that everything the Black Keys are doing is original, but it's nothing new. It's nothing that hasn't been done, and hasn't been done better, arguably, by the White Stripes.
Even the name of their band kind of flows in the White Stripe band, because you have a color plus an object.
Yeah.
You know, like White Stripes, Black Keys. It's kind of like they should just, you know, it sounds like that would.
I kind of like it because it's a dichotomy between two competing bands that don't really like each other anyway. But like I said, they did draw. I mean, Meg and Jack are the first two really successful two-person bands, I mean, as far as mainstream success goes. And what I love about them is that they've never, ever changed their style.
They've done different things.
Their albums don't change.
Icky Thump doesn't really sound like their first album.
It does, though. The album in general sounds
well, like their aesthetic,
the same.
Maybe, but like just
okay.
They
let me finish my point.
Okay.
Because you didn't even let me finish what I was going to say. They haven't changed their style. All they've done is each album experiments with different sounds on like a song to song basis. So like one song might seem completely different than every other song on the album, but when you listen to the album as a whole, and you see that every album has these experiments, then as a whole, they haven't changed their style at all. They've really just experimented. They haven't experimented with it to see how well it plays with the audience. They've experimented with it because Jack White's interested in that type of music. He just wants to play a couple songs from the 60s and see how he can render them. He's not really doing it to find a style, because they already have a style. They've always had their, you know, the two-person, the drum and the guitar. He's famous for not using bands in his concerts. Every once in a while, they'll bring like a bass line out or another instrument when there was a three-part portion. But for the most part, their concerts were just Meg White and Jack White playing.
When I saw the Black Keys live, they had two other people.
Right.
I mean, there was a part where they dropped the two people to do a few songs for just them. But for most of the concert, it was them and two other, like a keyboardist and a bassist.
and I do know that before they gained a lot of mainstream success, it was just those two playing for the most part. And so, you know, I'll give them credit for that, but again, that's not an original style. And it really hurts to hear people say, well, these Black Keys, they're new and they're original, but everything they're doing is really just a repeat of other bands. I'm using the White Stripes as an example, because the White Stripes are by far the most like the Black Keys. But other bands have done this in the past, and like I said, they did it before they had any mainstream success. It's just everyone attributes this sound and this style to them, and they take it in. They won't argue with anybody, and they won't even lend credit to the people that did influence that style. They won't, even if you hated Michael Jackson, if you're a pop star, you're going to attribute some of your success to him, because he paved the way. And I feel like the White Stripes did the same thing with that style of music.
Oh, yeah, Jack White is always giving credit to pretty much every blues, every, you know,
he doesn't claim to have created something new, because I think the way he sees it, he's just taking all these other parts and putting them together in a different way. But he doesn't feel that he's created a whole new style, even though I would argue the style he created really was pretty new.
It was new in a retro sense.
Yeah.
And really, it's what...
It's like hipsters. Like,
It's what kickstarted, really, you know, the people... It's at the early 2000s, it was, you know, people claimed that they were saviors of rock because, you know, they were doing something... If you listened to the radio at the time, it was just all Nickelback and Godsmack and stuff like that.
I had lost hope for a while. And there was all these post-grunge bands that kind of carried over into the 90s, or into the 2000s, early 2000s, into, like, mainstream rock, basically.
And so to, like, you know, people who were looking for something different, the White Stripes, even though what they were doing was really, a more modern take on, like, a 60s style of rock, it still sounded fresh and new compared to what everything else was going on at the time.
Right. And even just the style, like the fact that it was just a drum and guitar is not original, but is not popularly done. And they're really, they're really the first band to come to gain mainstream success solely as a two-person band.
All right. Now to the last part, some new music news. Many of you may be aware, but for those of you who aren't, Stone Temple Pilots recently got a new lead vocalist, none other than Chester Bennington of Linkin Park fame, and they put out a new song recently, and I think it's called, if I can check up real fast, well, I don't have it right in front of me, but I don't remember what it's called, but the name really isn't that important, because it's really probably not worth your time to listen to it.
It was not. We listened to the single, and I was not impressed. This is coming from somebody, and Jake can verify, I actually used to really enjoy Linkin Park, and I'm personally a pretty good fan of Chester. I think he's a great vocalist. The problem is, I'm more of a fan from a musical perspective of Stone Temple Pilots. Again, we talked about earlier, I love the 90s, and I love grunge, and the Stone Temple Pilots were absolutely seminal to that time period, and Scott Weiland was an absolutely incredible vocalist. And now that they've replaced Scott with Chester, it just doesn't seem like it fits. You know, you can't be the Stone Temple Pilots with this other huge band member who's not known for anything from the 90s, really. I mean, Hybrid Theory didn't come out until 2000. Yeah.
Right at the beginning, yeah.
I mean, it was...
See, I'm not a fan of Linkin Park, period. I've never enjoyed them, even when I was young and they were on the radio, new at the time. I just always thought that... I don't know. It just nothing in their music really appealed to me personally at all. And I've never been a huge Stone Temple Pilots fan either. I mean, they have a few songs... I think are all right, and a lot of the stuff that I have heard from them that I do enjoy isn't really the radio, like big radio singles. It's more of the stuff that they've, like their Beatles-esque stuff they've done on some of their albums that I've enjoyed. And when Scott Weiland isn't trying to sound like Eddie Vedder, he actually can be a pretty decent vocalist. It's just when you combine them with Chester Bennington, that's not even a...
It almost screams just mainstream rock.
It screams like a publicity stunt, because I don't even, like...
Yeah.
When those two bands aren't even really compatible. Like, when we heard Chester sing on it, it sounds like at first he's trying to do a bad Scott Weiland impression.
It seems like really strained and, like, undertoned.
And then he does a little bit of his
scream.
But it doesn't fit.
Yeah.
Period. And then he goes back to his Scott Weiland impression.
Weiland just doesn't do that in his music. just don't fit.
If I was gonna continue on as the band without Scott Weiland, I would have went like an Alice in Chains route and
actually about to say that. And get somebody who's unknown.
Somebody who doesn't. Who isn't
That's weird
like
you said that? I was seriously about to use Alice in Chains as an example.
Like somebody that an audience like would hear and wouldn't recognize and go, why is the Linkin Park guy singing these Stone Temple Pilots songs?
It's that's like, the big issue, I think.
It's they tried to go the Van Halen route where they pick a lead singer that everybody already knows.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference between them, not that I'm saying like Sammy Hagar and Van Halen was that good anyways, but mm-hmm. but at least they played similar styles of music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like new metal and grunge aren't really similar outside of maybe having some heavy guitar, but like Linkin Park really aren't even known for their heavy guitars.
No, they're really more known for the rap core.
Yeah, and then Chester's like, some would say, I would say whiny vocals, you say emotive and powerful.
But I think lyrically they were pretty whiny, but
yeah.
But I do like his voice. It's just that, and yeah, and I was seriously about to talk about Alice in Chains. It worked extremely well for Alice in Chains to have somebody who was just unknown. Nobody knew who he was. And he sounds so similar that it's like you could listen to their album and not focus on the voice. You can listen to the music of Alice in Chains
and not be like,
not get caught up.
Not be like, who is this poser trying, right. You know, like, which is exactly what you feel when you turn on Stone Temple Pilots.
Right. Yeah, I would go to an Alice in Chains concert and just love it. Even if all they played was old stuff, that would be fine with me. But yeah, I mean, I could never go to a Stone Temple Pilots concert now with Chester as their lead singer and enjoy myself. I hope when they do concerts, he doesn't play Scott Weiland's music.
Oh, you know they will though. Because who would go? Because I don't know anybody who would go and just want to go see, right. Like Chester and Stone Temple Pilots play new music, like. It's just, I don't know who they're trying to appeal to. I really think
they're going
to
lose a lot of their base. A lot of
their
fan
hopefully,
base.
Maybe it's just a one-off. Maybe they just put out the single and they realize that there's that there isn't a strong interest in hearing the Stone Temple Pilots with the Linkin Park vocalist, and they decide to go a different route.
Hopefully.
But if they do end up deciding to put out a full album with him as their vocalist, I don't think it will sell very well, and I think everybody will realize how stupid of an idea it was, and they'll all just go their separate ways.
Yeah,
because honestly, they should have just, if this is the route they should have just broken up with Scott when they fired Scott Weiland, because there's no future here.
Right. I think Scott Weiland has a better future than this band.
And he put out a shitty Christmas album, so that says something.
But yeah, and I don't know, like, cause I hope Chester the best. I hope he decides not to stay with Stone Temple Pilots, but I hope he continues to experiment. I'll probably listen to his music if he puts out, you know, if he works, you know, on his own side projects some more. I've listened to some of their other side projects, and I've really enjoyed him. I don't want to bag on him. But at the same time, he's just
you have
not
no choice.
I don't have any choice because I love Stone Temple Pilots more than I like Chester, and so it's like if he sucks, I have to put my foot in.
And I think that about wraps up for this episode of This Boring Life. We may end up changing the name of the podcast because I don't know if that really fits the music theme anymore. But still, it still fits in the theme with late night conversations that you record in your basement, which is, once again, exactly what we're doing right now.
1:30 in the morning now?
Yeah, so I think I just want to do a short plug in at the end, because I think, well, the right direction we're going to take this podcast, we're going to probably do a blog in addition to this, where we'll do reviews of new albums as well as editorial articles, because I think that would be a good fit, you know, in addition to the podcast. So be on the lookout. Don't really have a name or a website for that yet. Right now it's just in the planning stages, but hopefully by the next episode, whenever we get around to recording it, hopefully not another year in between them, we'll have something.
Give us your feedback too. Let us know what we can do to change it. If there's something you guys want us to talk about, any albums you guys want us to talk about, specific music, we'll listen to it and we'll review it. So
until next time, this is This Boring Life with Jake Waters
and Johnny McFarlane.
Good night, or good morning, or good afternoon if you're listening to it in the afternoon.